Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello and welcome to Just the Facts, the podcast that features candid conversations with your favorite actors and filmmakers. And welcome to episode 22. How are you? Happy Tuesday, if indeed you are listening to this on the morning of its release. If not, happy whatever day. Hope you're good, whatever you're up to. Whatever your plans are, thank you for making this show part of your day. I'm excited. I'm excited about episode 22, as today I have a phenomenal filmmaker joining me in the human form of the brilliant Mr. Edgar Wright, to talk about Last Night in Soho. And there is plenty of talk about his wonderful new movie, which comes out in cinemas this Friday, the 29th of October. And it's just amazing. It's a beautiful, delirious, fever dream of a movie. And one of those films that absolutely belongs on the big screen. I loved it. Go out and see it. I mean, it's up to you. I'm not telling you to, but that's my recommendation. My recommendation is to get to the cinema and see it. But as always on the show, there is a lot of other chat as well. We talk about ghosts, both metaphorical and literal, and we discuss what a crazy undertaking it was for Edgar filming this movie on the actual streets of Soho. Also, if you're familiar with Edgar and his work, you already know that he is someone who knows a lot about cinema. And now you can add to that, he knows a lot about Soho. I mean, we do talk a lot about Soho on the show anyway, because for a lot of our British guests, both actors and filmmakers alike, Soho has been a huge part of their lives. It's the heart of the entertainment industry, whether it's auditions, post-production. I mean, we had Paul Feig on the other week, actually from his Soho edit suite, putting the finishing touches to his new film. But today is different, because if you've never visited Soho, or even if you have, you are about to get a fascinating, vivid, and at times eye-opening tour of this famous square mile of the capital and its colourful and obviously at times sordid history. That's all coming up. That is all coming up in our conversation today and a lot more in between. That'll be here in like 30 seconds time. Very quickly though, a little bit of housekeeping before we get into the conversation. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at JTFpod, where you can get in touch with us and find out all the latest details on the show and our upcoming guests. Also, do please take a moment to visit our rather special new website that my producer Grant built for us. Thank you, Grant. There you can sign up to our newsletter and become part of our ever-growing Just the Facts community. That's jtfpod.com. If you do like the show, please just take a moment to give us a little rating and review. It really is a massive help on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. And tell your friends about us. Right, let's do this, shall we? Yes, I think we shall. Because welcome to Just the Facts, the magnificently talented filmmaker, it's Edgar Wright. Edgar, mate, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Nice to see you.
It's really, really, really nice to see you. So, lovely room you're in, by the way. It's very, very chic.
I'm probably appropriately for this movie, I'm in the Soho Hotel. And if it looks a bit like a strange angle that you're seeing on the Zoom, this will mean nothing to people listening, but I'm sitting on the floor because the floor is, these coffee tables are sort of very low. So I sort of like to sit on the floor cross-legged. Uh-huh. This, you can cut this bit out. This means nothing to people just listening to it.
No, it's nice. I like it. It feels like a slightly more bohemian kind of interview. It's lovely. You're on the floor. Hey, let's start with congratulations on Last Night in Soho. What an incredible film, mate.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. It's something that I've... It feels weird to like it to be finally coming out because I feel a little bit like it's like a kid leaving home or something. I don't know quite what I'm going to do with myself when it's out there because I've sort of been thinking about it for so long. Even, you know, like before we even started shooting, I'd been thinking about it for a decade. And then, you know, within shooting, then also we had, you know, like a lockdown and a hiatus. And so it's that thing where it wasn't finished until Christmas last year. And then we pushed the release so it could come out in cinemas and also come out in the autumn. I kind of felt like it was like a film that needs to come out when the nights are getting colder. And so now it's finally sort of coming out and I won't quite know what to do with myself. I don't really want to say goodbye to the story or the, you know, anything about it. It's weird.
Does it feel considerably different to previous releases? No, I guess because not just of the delay in bringing it out and all the time that you've had to sort of think about it, but also because it is, you know, Soho's your home. You live 5 minutes away.
I know. I think that's part of the problem is that I'm still haunted by it because I see the locations from the film every day. Like, it's so that's kind of strange. And so it's something where I guess there's a point where I think with a lot of films is that feeling that like you have to make a film because it's like haunting you at a certain point where you can't stop thinking about it. Many of the films I've done, it's got to that point where you have to try and make the movie so you'll stop thinking about it. That certainly would have been the case with Shaun and Hot Fuzz and Baby Driver and this is like you have to try and make the movie just so you can get it out of your head. Mm. And I think probably because it's like I've, you know, like made a movie where I sort of like, you know, I mean, what do they say? Don't shit where you eat. Where like, I guess I've made a movie on my own doorstep in a sense. And so it's like, I can't escape it, even though normally it would be a process of letting it out into the world and never having to think about it again, but I can't. So it will haunt me forever, I guess.
I mean, that's interesting because I emailed you straight out of the screening because I came out of Universal and I walked straight into Soho and I found myself on Carlisle Street opposite the Toucan pub, a pub I've walked past 100 times, and it suddenly felt completely different. It felt like I was looking at a piece of film history. Do you get the same vibe when you walk past the Toucan pub now? Are you like, there are stories in those walls that I have created?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think about it a lot in terms of, I think this is the same with Christy Wilson Cairns, who I wrote the screenplay with. And one of the reasons we paired up on it is I think there are people who walk around a big city. You could say this about any city and not just London and not just Soho. You walk around the city and never think about the past. To me, London is one of those places, and Soho as a square mile is particularly like this, that it's impossible for me to walk around without thinking about what it was, because the buildings are hundreds of years old. The ground floors change, but once you look above the ground floor, like the buildings are the same. And, you know, I think a lot about what the walls have seen. And if I'm in one of those places, I think it's probably the thing that started me thinking about this film is just, you know, sitting in offices or sitting in like a hotel room or like a flat or somewhere in central London or even in Soho itself and starting to wonder what used to be in this building and who used to live there. And there are things that are put forward in the film, the idea of what ghosts are, that, you know, I believe this. And maybe it's going growing up with a mum who is very sort of supernaturally switched on, shall we say. I mean, my mum is in some ways is very similar to Eloise, is that she is somebody who sort of very vividly feels presences and sometimes is even, you know, seen kind of ghosts, essentially. And when I was growing up, that would be stories that I'd hear from my mum. I mean, these are things that, like, sometimes there are things that happened to her when she was a teenager, mm-hmm. and sometimes there are things that had happened to her that day. I think both me and my brother were never skeptical about that. But it was always, when people tell you those things very matter-of-factly, then it's very sort of compelling in a way. And I guess part of it, being like a horror fan growing up, there was a part of me that was envious of her for having seen a ghost and I hadn't seen one. So still to this day, I haven't seen a ghost, but I would still like to. So if any are listening, I'm happy to be visited.
Do you believe in ghosts then? I mean, not just in the sort of...
I do. I mean, I do in the sense of, like, there's a line in the movie where, like, Thomas and Mackenzie asks Diana Rigg if somebody has died in her room. And she replies, "This is London. Someone's died in every room, in every building in this whole city and every street corner too." I believe that. And moreover, I mean, there's two theories about ghosts. One would be like a ghost souls that are left on earth in purgatory with unfinished business. They can't go to heaven or hell. So they're forced to remain on earth with this unfinished business. Or is it just the psychic residue left behind by an event? So do you believe that if a murder had happened in a room, that anything from that was left behind other than the physical, like, you know, sort of effects of it? Like, I mean, I believe that. And I think sort of a lot of people have that feeling of they come into a room and it's like, there's something about this place that's, you know, spooking me out. And then they discover that something actually happened there, you know?
And so did that weird feeling, I say weird feeling, that's an interesting feeling. Did that feeling inform where you picked to set some of the key scenes in the movie? Like, for example, take the Toucan Pub that we were just talking about. Obviously, I think that place had its own crazy history in the 60s.
It does. Like, it was owned by... I've got to remember the name of the club. It had a great name. It was kind of something like Knuckles Club or something.
Yes.
Yeah, it was Knuckles,
yeah,
right?
It was.
Owned by the drummer from the Pretty Things. If I've got the musician, I know it's the Pretty Things. If it's not the drummer, I apologize. But it does say in their history that Jimi Hendrix played there once. And when you go into the basement of the Toucan and you hear that Jimi Hendrix played there, you're thinking, where? There's literally like room for about 12 people standing in that place. If he did play there, if he had a 4-piece band, including him, there must have been like 8 other people in the room, which had been a very exclusive gig. But yes, no, it does. That place really does have its history. And yeah, it did sort of in terms of inform the streets because, you know, like Soho has become obviously very gentrified in the last like 25 years. I've lived in London for 27 years. When I first moved to London, the red light district was so much bigger and so much more prevalent. And like, you know, would be whole streets of it would be like streets which now are kind of very upmarket, like Great Windmill Street, which is full of like boutiques and nice restaurants, was all kind of like clip joints and kind of, you know, sort of peep shows. And it's very strange to me. One of the things that you always used to really disturb me about Great Windmill Street, and weirdly, the one thing that's remained is the kind of the more innocent part of it. But there's a primary school in the middle of that street. And you would very strangely like walk down that street and there would be ladies outside the clip joints. And it haunts me to this day that a lady that would say, "Sexy bed show, sir. Sexy bed show, sir." And she was next door to a primary school and you could hear the kids on break playing. And I was just thinking, these are the things that kind of you can see where the film is coming from now. It's like they would be the things that would really, I'd find does anybody else find this as weird as me that you can hear children playing next to like a clip joint? It was very odd to me. That's sort of gone away, but then it also hasn't. That's the thing about Soho, is that I feel like the later at night it gets, the more the kind of the Soho of old starts to kind of rise up.
Mm.
And it's a very sort of profound energy change if you spend a lot of time in the area. And it feels like the square mile of Soho is slightly like a law unto itself. And it feels one of those places, which why it's featured in literature and film for like hundreds of years, is because it feels like that place where it's very easy to get lost, even in just this square mile, and very easy to make a bad decision. And I think in a way, like, the film is sort of haunted by tragic tales of, you know, showbiz and careers cut short, or people that didn't even make it at all. And those are things that I think about a lot. And I know sort of Christy felt the same way, is that, you know, you hear stories about kind of, you know, terrible like left turns in people's lives and careers. And, you know, the shadows of the past like loom large. And I find it sort of difficult to forget, you know.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, you're absolutely right. Obviously, Soho's changed, and this reference is on the cusp of Soho. But I remember watching American Werewolf in London, and there's the adult cinema, let's call it, in Piccadilly Circus. And I watched that, and I was like, that can't have been there. That would have never been there in the 80s. And I went digging around; it was really there, like just in the center of Touristville in London. You've got, you know, a dirty flicks place.
Well, now it's I think it's now, there was a gap. It changed into a gap for a while.
Yes.
But it was actually at the time of filming. It's funny because I've asked John Landis this myself, because I remember when I first came to London, when I came to London on a school trip when I was about 15, and we had like a free period to go and run around London. And me and my friend Graham, we went straight to Piccadilly Circus, A, to sort of go to Tower Records, which was there at the time, and B, see if we could find the porn cinema from American Werewolf in London. And it wasn't there anymore. But I think when they shot the movie, there was a cinema there. But at that point, when they shot the movie in 1981, it was a Disney cartoons cinema.
Yes.
They used to have those cinemas that would just kind of run cartoons 24 hours, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I remember during lockdown, those fantastic photos that you were posting of these almost deserted streets around Soho. And I was like, did you do that for fun, or was that part of the process? Because lockdown was different for everyone. Was it part of a kind of sanity maintaining process, sort of going out and taking those pictures around Soho?
Well, it was very, sad. Like at the start of lockdown, when we had to go on hiatus, we had to stop what we were doing. We couldn't even edit the film, because we actually, at the point when the first lockdown happened, we were about to do some additional filming with all the cast. And it was literally about to happen the next week. And I had this feeling, even as we were prepping it, that it wasn't going to happen, because, you know, you were reading the news and seeing what was coming. As soon as, I think everybody in the film industry started to really think, oh shit, is when No Time to Die moved. I feel that's when everybody in the film industry suddenly took it really seriously, thinking, wait, what do they know that we don't? This is obviously bad news. And we had to stop, we had to go on hiatus, and we didn't really know when we were going to be back or whether we were even going to be able to shoot the stuff that we did, which we eventually did later in that summer. And I guess during that period, I was walking around a lot in the center of London, and I couldn't stop taking photos of empty Soho. And then eventually, and this isn't a spoiler, but in the end credits of the movie, you do see some shots of empty Soho, which we shot one night. I was so sort of compelled, exactly those photos that you're talking about. I called my producer and I said, hey, we have to shoot lockdown Soho, because when is it ever going to look like this ever again? It's so, you know, because Soho is so 24 hours. It's the only part of London that feels like there's always somewhere that's open. It's the one place that's like genuinely 24/7, which when we were shooting the movie made it very complicated to do, you know, shooting the actual scenes in Soho for real, both the 60s stuff and the modern day stuff. And now it's like empty, completely empty of cars and pedestrians. There's nobody on the streets. So one night, I think it was like July 2020, with the City of Westminster's permission, we weren't allowed to put a tripod down. We weren't allowed to put track down, but they said, as long as you're not stopping like cars or pedestrians, you can shoot wherever you want. So we actually went out with a Steadicam, and we just had one lens. We didn't change a lens, and it was just a small crew of about 10 people. I think I was the AD as well. We didn't have an AD. So we just walked around and just took shots of Soho on the Steadicam. And then so the shots that are in the end credits of the movie, I guess it's basically like a little epilogue of like lockdown Soho and just chronicling all those empty streets. And also, I think originally, before even the lockdown thing, I wanted to do something where I shot every alley in Soho. Because if you know Soho well, it's like the alleys are sometimes as important as the main roads, you know. And certainly back in the 60s, when you see shots of those alleys back then, when like the kind of the nightclub scene, both above board and below board, was much, much bigger. All of those alleys were kind of, you know, places to go and make some bad decisions.
I mean, you mentioned it. I just don't understand how you managed to shoot in Soho. Because I'm like you, I spend a lot of time in Soho, and it's never not busy. Like it just isn't. And indeed, like sort of the period that you think, oh, it's going to get quieter at like 3 a.m, is the period where a whole different Soho wakes up. How scared were you at the prospect of actually going, we're going to do this for real in Soho?
Well, it's scared, but also it was the thing that was driving me to do it. Like, if we'd have had to fake it somewhere else, I probably wouldn't have made the movie. It was sort of the first thing that, when we talked about making it, probably the first meeting that we had, me and Marcus Rowland, my production designer, was with Camilla Stevenson, the location manager, just to talk about the practicality of doing it. Because what I didn't want to do is fake it elsewhere. And, you know, sometimes, especially period movies, if they're doing like period London, they'll shoot somewhere else. Like films like Judy or Legend might shoot in East London or shoot somewhere else. Or sometimes people shoot in Manchester or Liverpool for period London. Mm. But here, we wanted to grab the bull by the horns and not only shoot the modern day scenes in Soho itself, but the 60s stuff as well, which we did. And so all of the locations in the movie are where they say they are. Like, you know, Eloise lives first in halls of residence in Fitzrovia, then she moves to a bedsit in Fitzrovia, and then where she works and where all the 60s stuff happens is in Soho. In like Old Compton Street, Dean Street, Frith Street, Greek Street, the Toucan, Soho Square, Piccadilly Circus. Like, we just shot everything as it was. And that was challenging for the modern day stuff, because you sort of just have to grab the bull by the horns, and it becomes like a war of attrition at some point. You just have to kind of stake out where you're going to shoot. And you've kind of got this small army of PAs and location assistants, who are the people working the hardest on those days, just asking people politely to not walk through shot. And then, you know, working with the City of Westminster to kind of do some road closures on certain days. But those things have to be done months in advance. Like the shot where Thomas and Mackenzie, when she first goes into the 60s and walks across the Haymarket into the Café de Paris. We use the Empire on Haymarket as a double. The real Café de Paris is just around the corner, but actually not quite as nice a street to shoot in. So we shot on the Haymarket instead. But that had to be run by, we had to give the City of Westminster 5 months' notice. Wow. So that is why, when people say, why don't more people shoot in Soho, is that, you know, we were lucky that we had a long pre-production to do those things. Even like the other streets, like in Soho, is like 3 months' notice. So that's the challenging part, is then you're locked into those days. And like, if you know, so you don't have a lot of flexibility. The City of Westminster were really helpful to us and let us shoot, but we had to shoot those scenes on those dates, and there's no way around it, you know. So, I mean, I'm very proud of the location work in the movie, because it is ambitious. And I think, especially if you know London and that area, sometimes people are watching and saying, wait, how did you guys do that?
100%.
Like, well, we just did it. We shot, I mean, I think the most impressive shot for people who know London, is the shot. It's in the second dream sequence when Matt Smith and Anya Taylor-Joy are driving up Frith Street and they turn a corner into Bateman Street and they park in Greek Street all in one shot. And all of the ground floor is all dressed into the 60s, which Marcus Rowland, our production designer, did. And, you know, period extras and cars. But just out of frame is the modern world. And there's a scene when, like, when Anya and Matt leave this nightclub and they're sort of talking in the street and they're sort of like romantically walking down the street. Like, he twirls her around and they're talking outside this clothes shop and they're doing all their dialogue and they're such pros because, like, out of the corner of it, it's like now 3 a.m. I think maybe on a Friday, a Thursday or something. And just out of frame is like a fight happening with some people ejected from a nightclub and a bouncer. And, you know, fair play to Anya and Matt. They just kept on acting. They weren't going to let the modern world dissuade them. I mean, we had similar things even when we shot outside nightclubs. There's a scene outside a nightclub in Vauxhall where I think we were shooting on like a Sunday night. And even on a Sunday night, there were like sort of, there's a scene with like Thomas and Mackenzie and Michael Ageo where they kept on acting even as like drunk people are like walking into shot. And I was really impressed by the actors. Just kind of, they felt, okay, we're just going to do our thing and we're not going to be bothered by everything else that's going on.
I was going to say, I mean, 4 a.m. in Soho, the kind of people who are around who see lights and cameras and film sets don't tend to be the kind of people who just casually walk on by. They're the kind of people who will go, what's going on here? What are you doing, mate?
Well, we had some, you know, I have to shout out again the locations department and security and stuff, because, you know, also there are people who don't want cameras around at all. Mm. And so even that is something where, like, you're kind of like impinging on what they want to be doing. Like, so I think there were some sort of moments there where, like, people are starting to kind of, you know, are just alarmed that there are like cameras around, you know, because it's not something that, it's not usually on screen that much. But I mean, it was, one of the other amazing shots, actually, this doesn't seem like an ambitious shot, but it was, is whilst we were shooting that stuff with Anya and Matt and doing the 60s stuff, I had like a second unit around the corner. And I asked my editor, Paul Matchless, to basically, you know, shoot. I'd run back and forth and he kept shooting shots. Is right at the start of the film, you see Thomasin as Eloise go out with the girls from the London College of Fashion on their first night out, but they go out on a school night and get hammered on a Sunday night, the day before registration. And you see a shot of them walking down Old Compton Street, which is the main drag in Soho.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And we shot those shots of the girls walking down the middle of Old Compton Street on a Steadicam hidden within a rickshaw. And basically the rickshaw was pulling ahead of the girls and the girls were just walking down and just walking through Soho. So most people didn't see a film crew. They just saw these, they didn't know that they were actresses. So those shots, which are actually in the trailer, were essentially done with a hidden camera in a rickshaw. And, you know, you have all the signs put up. You probably walked through when you've seen a film location, it has those signs that's like a legal disclaimer saying, you know, if you walk through here, you may be, you know. Also, I don't know if you spotted the other stuff that I think is kind of ambitious on a location element is there's a whole sequence later where Thomas and Mackenzie is running down Oxford Street and across Oxford Circus. And, you know, we shot that for real as well. Like, and we have some of our extras in that, but there's a shot when she runs across Oxford Circus. And, you know, we have a Steadicam on Oxford Circus and we just like, we're standing one side and it's like, as soon as the green man goes, you run for it, like, and run past the camera. The truth is that also, and you know this, is that Londoners for the most part, and you can say this about most big cities, they don't really give a fuck. Like, so, most people are so wrapped up in their own problems and maybe even looking at their smartphones whilst they're walking that they wouldn't have even noticed that a film was shooting. Yep. And certainly, did a single Londoner stop the clearly distressed Eloise to see if she was okay? Of course not. So she's running around like having like a sort of, you know, like having a waking nightmare panic attack, but nobody really sort of said, are you okay?
It is quite amazing what you've done for Soho, though. I mean, I was watching it and I remember the first time I went to New York, I think it was about 2003. And for me, the first time I went to New York, it was like stepping on to a film set, just one giant film set, because I've seen so many films shot there. And genuinely, for the first time, walking around Soho after watching this film, it suddenly became that kind of magical experience where you feel like you're on just one big film set.
Well, I guess it's because it's a neighborhood where I've spent the most time in London. I mean, even before I sort of moved into central London when I was editing Baby Driver like 5 years ago and basically never left. But prior to that, I had spent more time in Soho than any like sofa in any flat that I've ever lived in. I mostly lived in North London whilst I've been living in London for the last 27 years. But because Soho is like a nightlife area, restaurants, cinemas, theatre, comedy, music, everything. And then also the center of the film and TV industry. And because I've edited everything I've done right back to Spaced in Soho. And so you just end up through that, like seeing it at all hours of the day. And, you know, like you said, a lot of like nighttime walks or sort of finishing work at like 2 a.m. and coming out and seeing what Soho is like at 2 a.m. And I even remember like vividly when I was editing Spaced, I think it was the second series. So it would have been like late 2000. And there was a point where me and Paul Matchless were editing the series. And I think I went in on the 29th of December to edit Summer Spaced on my own. And I had the keys for the edit suite at Goldcrest, which is on Brewer Street. And I was walking down the middle of Old Compton Street in Soho on December the 29th, completely deserted, snow on the ground. Nobody else on the street. This is like 8:30 in the morning, and maybe even on a Sunday or something. And I was walking down the street and I looked up Dean Street, and outside a brothel on Dean Street, the one directly opposite the Groucho Club. Maybe we're getting too in now, but
no, I know.
None of these things are tourist recommendations. But I walked past and there was a guy standing outside the closed door of this brothel, and he was the only other person on the street. He turns around and looks at me and he says, "What time do they open?" Which made me just like, I remember collapsing with laughter, because I just love the thought that he would just ask a random stranger that, or just the idea that I knew. Like, so I just thought that was amazing. And so it's like things like that happen in Soho all the time. And it's one of those places that if you're a tourist and you're just walking around going to a restaurant or a bar or like a club, you might not notice those things. But once you stand still for like more than 90 seconds, something will happen. And it might not be a good thing. So it's like, it's interesting to me. It's like, sort of, I think that's the thing, is that you look back in just in terms of literature, like back to sort of like, you know, Dylan Thomas and Oscar Wilde and further back, is like, the stories are just all there. I mean, there's this amazing book actually that was written in the 20s that I read when I was like sort of writing this by Patrick Hamilton. It's a series of three books called 20,000 Streets Under the Sky. It's really brilliant. And it's set in like Fitzrovia and Soho. And there's one chapter of the book which describes a blackout drunk night in Soho that is so terrifying, just in terms of like imagining 1920s Lyle Street. And then also just thinking like, oh God, this is like, I feel like I'm getting kind of like just kind of PTSD just reading this kind of chapter. But this isn't from now, this is from the 20s. So you can just see that this area has kind of cast such a thrall over like artists for so many years. And so that was one of the things that I just wanted to see that on screen. And like London obviously appears on screen a lot, but usually it's other areas of London that appear on screen, or a big budget movie might have a scene in Trafalgar Square where somebody lands a helicopter, or if it's any spy film or superhero film, there will be that helicopter shot of London Bridge and the gherkin at the start of every X-Men movie. or the Millennium Bridge will be brought down by the Death Eaters or Andor Magneto Andor somebody else. So I just felt like it was like, with the exception of like in the last like 30 years or 35 years, maybe like there's only a few sort of like Soho movies, like Mona Lisa was the last big one with Bob Hoskins. And then Michael Winterbottom did a great film at the start of this century, Wonderland. And then obviously the parts of his Paul Raymond film as well. But Wonderland, I think, is a really good record of Soho. But for the most part, most people don't bother because it's difficult, you know?
Talking about the history of Soho, you can get lost in it. It's fascinating. What's quite fascinating is there are certain pubs that both claim the same story. Like I think the Dog and Duck on Bateman Street and the Wheat Sheaf on Rathbone Place both claim to be the pub where George Orwell, after he found out how well 1984 had done, drank a bottle of absinthe and threw up across the bar.
Well, weirdly, the pub that is in the movie is also, I think, the Newman Arms gets referenced in 1984. Rather, it was the inspiration for the pub in 1984. But then the Newman Arms, again, just around the corner on Rathbone Place, that is in Last Night in Soho, primarily because like it's a great location. It's around the corner from I shouldn't say where I live.
I was gonna say, really?
Okay, let me back up. It's nowhere near where I live. But it is in the opening sequence of Michael Powell's Peeping Tom. The opening sequence of Michael Powell's Peeping Tom is the Newman Arms and Newman's Passage. And also the newsagent is in Peeping Tom on the corner of Rathbone Place and Percy Street, is in the opening of the movie when Eloise hides from a taxi driver in a newsagent. It's that same one. And then what's also interesting, this will mean something to Brits, but not other people, but Newman's Passage also features in the opening titles of Minder, because it is where the Winchester Club is in Minder. For real.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
Well, when you watch the end credits of Minder, there's one shot of Dennis Waterman and George Cole pushing. There's a lamppost that's on a the piss, and they're pretending to hold up the lamppost. That's supposed to be the exterior of the Winchester Club, and it's Newman's Passage.
That's fascinating. I mean, in terms of the film itself, there are certain aspects of it that you can certainly describe as a love letter to the 60s, especially the buzz of Soho, the aesthetics and the music. When did you first, I guess, fall in love or become aware of the 60s or start imagining what this period in history might have been like?
It was really, and this is kind of like reflected in the opening scene of the movie, but it was really initially, because I was born in 1974, but my parents' record collection was quite small. They had one record box and all of the records were from the 60s, and they seemed to stop buying records in 1970. So it was, I guess it became clear to me later, is that my parents stopped buying albums when my older brother was born. And they didn't seem to collect albums into the 70s, not until me and my brother started buying records for us. But their collection was like from 64 to 70. And you know, back in those days when pre-internet, way pre-internet, but also even before having a TV in my bedroom, like I would listen to those records because they didn't anymore. And so, you know, Beatles records and Stones and, you know, Pink Floyd and Simon and Garfunkel, like just a lot of those like albums that I would like obsess about. And you sort of would have to back then just kind of like conjure up the decade through what you were listening to. And then I think beyond that, it's something where obviously the 60s cast such a long shadow in culture in the whole of the world, not just the UK, but like sort of 60s London is something that always people kind of refer back to as like, that was the time and that was the place. And this was the place kind of in swinging London where like, and Soho specifically was where it was at. Mm. And then what's interesting about that, and then what starts to inform the movie is that, you know, it's dangerous to be nostalgic because I would be very nostalgic for a decade that I never lived in. And I would have recurring time travel fantasies about going back to the 60s. And then you have to wonder, am I thinking about going back because I can't deal with the present day? And are you thinking about going back? Are you fooling yourself? Everything was great then, because that's not true. Is that everything that was bad, everything that's bad now was bad then. Mm. And some things were worse back then. Mm. But obviously, like, there's a tendency from some people to romanticize the past, especially people that weren't there. And when you do talk to people from this who were around in the 60s, four of them are in this movie, you know, that they obviously have great memories of the time, but they're always tempered with everything else, you know, that everything else that happened. And I think they probably, much like Eloise in the film, who in a couple of scenes talks with puppy doggish enthusiasm about the 60s to people who were there and are met with like a flat, unromantic response. Because I feel like I've been that person. Sometimes when you meet like a rock star from the 60s, and like if you met like a Beatle, or, you know, I mean, I have met a Rolling Stone and it was just embarrassing because I found myself just floundering, trying to make a conversation.
Well, which one did you meet?
Oh, I met Mick Jagger, and it was so embarrassing because I had nothing to say. Well, it's that thing. Sometimes when you meet heroes, you have nothing. You can't just offer up, oh, I'm a big fan, because they've heard everything. And usually you have to kind of think of something more offbeat. And in a way, like on this movie, you know, you don't want to open talking to Diana Rigg asking her about the Avengers. Mm. You want to talk around other stuff, or like, you know, Terrence Stamp, I thought it was interesting that he was a bit more forthcoming talking about working in Italy. Like, talk to him at length about making Toby Dammit with Fellini, or making Theorem with Pasolini, or making The Collector in Hollywood with William Wyler, or working with Peter Ustinov on Billy Budd. Mm. But less 60s Soho stories. And I also started to wonder if you're actually what people perceive to be the epicenter of the scene, can you even see it yourself objectively? Like Diana, if you asked her about the 60s, she'd have her kind of line where she says, oh, I don't remember the 60s. I was filming the Avengers. And I think that's not what she really felt, but it was like her way of kind of brushing off that question of like, what was it like to be a 60s icon? Because it's sort of a dumb question to ask a 60s icon. So I think with all of that in mind, and then, you know, like Rita Tushingham, on the other hand, she would talk about like how tough it would be, or rather, you know, the sense is that the 60s were super progressive. And of course, there were elements where they were, where, you know, things were changing rapidly. But that didn't mean it was happening to the whole of the country. It didn't even mean it was happening to the whole of London. Like the experiences of the Stones and the Beatles in the Ad Lib Club in 1965 and 1966 is not the experiences of the majority of the nation. And in fact, when you look at that archive material of the time, when you actually look at documentaries from the time, there's that thing when you see what most guys look like, everybody looks middle-aged. Even people in their 20s look like they're 40. I mean, I don't know if you noticed that in the nightclub scenes, but there's one of my favorite shots in the movie, and it's kind of a disturbing shot, is where Thomas and Mackenzie are sitting in this strip club, and she's surrounded by men in suits like kind of like the Mac Brigade, essentially. But there's that thing when you look at footage of the time is that you didn't have the thing, like, unless you were a pop star, you didn't dress young. Like, you wore a suit because you went to work and everybody looks like they're middle-aged. Like, so the idea that, you know, that people like ourselves, Alex, who kind of dress like we're in our 20s, well into our 40s.
It's so,
you know,
true.
What I'm talking about,
I,
Alex.
I got it.
Yeah. But listen, but that's something that didn't exist back then, unless you were a pop star or you were kind of maybe like in the scene. For the majority of people, like working like 9-to-5 jobs, or especially outside of London, you know, people look really straight. And so that's something that I thought was just interesting, is that it's almost like the 60s is only happening to like the top 1% of the nation, and everybody else is it's a little more drab than that. So, and that's something that even within Soho itself is like, there are the places where it's all happening and this is kind of like the center of swinging London. And then, you know, only like a door away, it kind of gets grottier and drearier. And I think that's the thing with like the sort of the thing about Soho itself is like the darkness is only just beyond those glittering lights. It's so close, and I think that's the thing where it is compelling and disturbing.
I mean, it's an amazing film, and I guess with the pandemic happening, well, how has that changed your plans for what you're doing next? Because I remember, I think the last time we spoke in person at the Esquire Townhouse Q&A, I think you were just about to start editing last night in Soho, or you were in the process of it. Baby Driver 2 was being talked about at that point. Is that something that's happening, or have the pieces moved?
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, I guess the pandemic knocked all of the pieces off the board in a way. And so I think the big thing that's changed is, I mean, the honest answer is I don't quite know what I'm doing. I've been promoting like 2 movies this year, and it's probably the most press I've ever done for films, just because I've done them back to back, but also I've really been trying to support the cinema experience and just kind of, I feel very passionately about that and want to help exhibitors as much as I can by just showing up and not just like promoting the movie, but being at screenings and just kind of like not asking anybody to do what I wouldn't do, you know, and that sometimes goes for like, you know, doing Q&As with other filmmakers for their movies. But, you know, like I have a lot of great things in development, including Baby Driver 2. And I think what the pandemic did was just kind of force you to kind of like think about the future in more practical terms, in the sense of like, I basically, you know, just relocated to London during the lockdown. I'm glad I did, actually. I'm glad I saw out the lockdown in London. And even though it was a very sort of sad time for the city, it just sort of weirdly made me fall in love with it all over again. So I don't really know what's next, and I don't know where it will be. I mean, there are certain things with something like Baby Driver, which is a very ambitious film to do, that trying to shoot that in the current lockdown situation would be quite challenging. It's a difficult thing to kind of, I know from people, I mean, I did some shooting right at the start of, in like August last year. We were one of the first films to start shooting again. And there was a point at Pinewood Studios where the only two films filming in the whole of the UK were Jurassic World and Last Night in Soho. And it was at the time when nobody really knew what COVID protocol was going to be. So we were one of the first films to sort of do it and say, hey, can we get through a week of filming and get everybody tested, and how's it going to work? And we were lucky in a way that we were at the start, because everybody was being very cautious and nothing was open as well. And I think sort of like as soon as the football started like this year, everything kind of went to shit. And I know lots of people who've been shooting movies, that's when people started to have these 10-day lockdowns where so-and-so has COVID and the entire production is shut down. And some of these big movies like having these multiple shutdowns costing like millions of dollars a week every time it happened. And I know people who've been shooting now that have sort of said it's actually tougher now than it was at the start of lockdown, if that makes sense. So the short answer is I don't know what I'm doing. But as soon as this film comes out and Last Night in Soho has left the house, so to speak, I get to kind of sit down with a clean desk, and one of the projects I have in development will make itself more apparent to me as the practical next move than the others.
It's so good that this film has come out in cinemas, not just for cinemas, but because it is the kind of movie. I mean, it's like this delirious, beautiful fever dream of a film, and it needs to be seen on the big screen. Were there ever murmurs during the middle of it, sort of whispers in the dark going, we may have to take this to streaming?
No, I got to say, like, Universal and Focus, you know, who made the movie, I never had that conversation. And they always, I think they all believed as well that it was something that was a theatrical experience. And I think in a strange way, actually, as has been borne out by the films that have been doing well, is that genre films are one of the things that kept people coming back. Because I think there's a sort of an understanding with audiences that films like, you know, like A Quiet Place was the first film back that was like a big hit. And I think that's because everybody just understood this would be better to see on the big screen with other people. And I think what's tougher is that there are certain films where people have sort of made a decision in their heads to say, I'll wait to watch that at home. And I hope that changes, because I think it's toughest on like indie films at the moment, because, you know, there are films that come out during award seasons that are maybe more challenging, that require you to be in a cinema and have committed to watching it, even to the point where you've paid your ticket. And I feel it's tough sometimes with some films that when they're at home and people are watching them streaming and they haven't physically paid for that movie, it's just one of many things on offer, that if it's something that requires your patience, I think you'd be shocked to find how many of those movies people don't actually sit through at all. And that's a worry, because I think whilst it's great that streamers like finance some of those movies, I wonder what percentage of the audience make it through to the end credits. Whereas if you watch it at the cinema, you know, it would have to be something major for you to walk out and not see it through to the end.
100%.
I think at home, people don't always have that patience.
Yeah. It's the immersiveness. I mean, you know, there are films like Roma, for example, or more recently, Nomadland, films that require you to be immersed in the world of the film to really appreciate the intentions of the filmmakers. And I think you have to be in the dark. You have to be immersed in the world. Whereas if you're at home, you can see them freaking washing up at the other side of the room or something.
You've got your screen in the wrong place, Alex. No, I mean, I totally agree. And I think actually Roma, I was very fortunate. I think when that came out, I saw it at the cinema like 3 times. But I've never watched it at home. And it's not something that I really feel the urge to, even though I got a nice kind of setup at home and stuff. But yeah, I always feel it's like, and by the way, I'm not like, I know people get kind of funny about it in terms of that you're somehow being privileged, just the idea of the cinema itself. I've watched hundreds of films at home in the last 18 months, literally hundreds, maybe like 500 plus. But at the cinema, the difference is that the film is in control. I always see it as like the film is like a train leaving the station, and you have to be there on time to get on the train to go on a journey with the movie. And the film is not stopping. So even if you have to go to the bathroom, like the film is going to carry on. And I think it's just something, it's literally more transportative when the film is in control than when you are in control of the film at home. Because then it's that thing where if you're watching like a 2.5 hour movie at home, you might say, hey, let's watch the rest of this tomorrow. Yeah. Or, you know, like, oh, I'm tired. We'll watch, you know, like it just, you know, the spell is broken more easily. So, and I think it's a sad thing sometimes for like films that, like last year, I felt for a lot of the films that were in award season that they hadn't really been hits with the public. As in, there were films, I think, something like Promising Young Woman, which in the UK went straight to Sky. I think that would have been an audience hit. If it had been in non-pandemic times, it would have been like a big fat hit with audiences. And I feel sorry in a way that that film didn't see those crowds.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. And I think it was... because I think a lot of the studios held back their sort of big name prestige movies as well. What you ended up with during award season was a lot of smaller movies. And I think some of those smaller movies would have perhaps benefited being in categories alongside bigger movies with recognizable names in that people go, oh, this is up there with, I don't know, I think they held back King Richard, the Serena and Venus Williams story. If perhaps that had been sitting alongside, Minari, people would have gone, oh, okay, I'm going to check out Minari.
No, totally. I think the problem, and it's a tough one to crack. The problem, yeah, like for the Oscars and the BAFTAs, what's tough is if there are smaller films that awards voters have seen and critics have seen, but the public has not. Sometimes the films haven't even come out. So what you have then, if there's a lot of films that the public don't know, and they're only going on the fact that critics have seen them and awards voters have seen them, it becomes a disconnect because the viewer at home is watching the award show, or rather not watching it at all. So they, I don't know any of these movies. Sometimes they haven't come out yet. And that's not a fault of the films themselves. But you're right, in previous years, almost like the perfect thing for award season is you have some big meaty blockbusters that people have heard of to hold, if not hold the other films up, but you might be, if you're invested in, is Black Panther going to win something? Or is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood going to win something? Or is 1917 going to win something? They might watch the show and see a clip from Minari and saying, hey, that looks interesting. We should watch that film as well. And the problem is like last year that didn't happen. And maybe this year it might be a similar thing. So it's difficult because, and that's also a problem, is that Hollywood have stopped making mid-range movies. And those are the films. I mean, in a weird way, that's what I'm dedicated myself to making those movies. Is like, we need more of these like mid-budget movies. Like Baby Driver is one of those. And so is Last Night in Soho, is like something that's like, it's not like a $200 million film, but it's also, it's not a tiny indie either. It's something like they used to make.
100%. It's become so polarized. It's one or the other, but you're right. All those movies that were original ideas, but still had enough budget to deliver some bang for the buck, but wasn't part of a franchise. They, like you say, they're few and far between. Edgar, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I don't want to over-sentimentalize at this, but you know, I remember being there with you in 2004 at the Shaun of the Dead premiere, and here I am talking to you in 2021 with Last Night in Soho, and it's been a pleasure being part of that journey with you, man.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate, and in fact, that after party for Shaun of the Dead was in Soho as well, as I remember.
Yeah, it was.
At the Atlantic, which now no longer exists.
You have a great rest of your day, man. And once again, congratulations with the film. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you, Alex. It really means a lot to me. And hopefully, I hope everybody enjoys the film and it will stop haunting me at some point.
I'll see you soon, I hope, mate.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.